Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And I have missed you in the last 2 weeks while I've been recuperating from my hip surgery. And I know we're in the beautiful month of February, or as Hallmark likes to call it, Loveuary. But since we missed the January issue of Science of Mind for the first 2 weeks, and I was gone for the next two, I am going to spend a lot of time with that issue and articles from it on today's program. The January Daily Guides were written by Reverend Kelly Robbins. A flower does not try to be beautiful. Its true nature is beauty. In the same way, when you awaken, you will naturally exude love, compassion, beauty. It is all you, for it is your true self. Robert Adams. January's Daily Guides were inspired by my love for January and its energetic opportunity to consciously engage the Science of Mind teachings in our lives. Stretching beyond intellectual understanding and into implementation, this time of year allows us to set a new personal boundary for what is possible. The year's first month is often filled with energy and enthusiasm to pursue our dreams and initiate change. I invite each of us to play with our creative tools and stretch beyond what we thought was possible. Reverend Kelly Robbins is a CSL minister and founder of Spiritual Living with Kelly Robbins. Her multifaceted ministry allows her to facilitate life's significant rituals and turning points with reverence and love. Her joy is officiating weddings and providing the Together Forever premarital counseling program, which guides couples to create a strong foundation for their marriage. She serves the community by honoring loved ones through memorials and celebrations of life, chaplaincy at a local hospital, and delivering Sunday talks at various Colorado CSL, Unity, and Divine Science churches. Robbins, the author of Trust Your Next Step, Creating the Confidence to Cut Fresh Tracks, is working on her second book to be released this year. And I want to pause for a moment to say that the theme for January was Stretch into Possibilities. And we'll just start right at the beginning of the month. Embrace new beginnings. The secret to change is to focus all of your energy not on fighting the old, but on building the new. Socrates. There is no strain or struggle in the universe. All the actions of life are harmonious, steady, sure, and quiet. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 244. This first day of 2025 is a day to embrace new beginnings, Centers for Spiritual Living's theme this year. Rising higher, growing deeper, brings to mind a visual of a tree. We see the tree trunk and branches growing higher, wider, expanding. What we don't see, which is happening simultaneously, is the growth of the roots, which also are growing deeper and expanding wider to support the growing tree. The roots give the tree the nourishment it needs to grow and thrive, and the stability to withstand the heavy winds and storms it may encounter. I imagine many of our New Year's resolutions have this same structure. Growth and expansion in areas others can see, as well as the breadth of deepening inward where no one can see but you. On the first day of 2025, reflect on the goals you set for yourself and take a step back. Did you include space for the roots of your soul to grow? We often focus on the effect, the outer expression of spirit. It's usually what others can see, and it is often measurable. Losing weight, saving more money, changing careers. However, we often fail to take time to nurture and strengthen our inner selves, the pure expression of God, Spirit, the universe, within each of us. These qualities are less tangible and more a state of being, qualities such as love, joy, power, or wisdom. Are you focusing on change that includes your roots so it lasts and will weather the storms that are sure to come? Affirmation. I am a powerful manifester, and I take time to nourish my soul. Love yourself. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. Buddha. If someone makes themselves receptive to the idea of love, they become lovable. To the degree that they embody love, they are love. So people who love are loved. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 150. Most of us set relationship goals, whether in a love relationship, strengthening or healing familiar relationships, relationships at work, or developing friendships. I invite us today to focus on our relationship with ourselves. Without healthy self-love, there is no other love. Our very nature is pure love. While love may be difficult to describe, we know it instantly when we experience it. Love expects nothing, demands nothing, costs nothing. Love is unconditional and in harmony with all things. Love is the energy from which all life flows. Each of us is born with nothing but pure love inside us. Every major religion teaches love. It is the essence of our light, the building block of all we create, live, and breathe. God, the divine, source, spirit, creator, universal energy, this is the love inside us. Thinking, acting, and being in love is being one with God. Often we look for love outside ourselves in relationships, in our actions, in our achievements and results. What is essential is to recognize we are love, and loving ourselves is the most important thing we can learn in this lifetime. You are an inexhaustible source of love, nothing else. We don't receive love from another, but we can feel the resonance of their love. The key is to experience the love from within. We must love ourselves to truly love others. Affirmation. Today I choose to love myself unconditionally, exactly as I am. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, shine. I shine my divine light into the world. During times of meditation, prayer, or any other spiritual practice, I feel as though the loving light of God, of Spirit, of the universe, is shining directly upon me. These wonderful interludes uplift and comfort me, letting me know I am one with all God is. In this place of oneness, I feel a glow with the light of God, of Spirit, of the universe. This divine light shines within me and blesses me with deep feelings of peace and joy. The light also shines from me, radiating into the world and all those I meet. I share the fruits of spiritual living in all my encounters. I am peaceful, even in tense situations. I am kind, even if others are not. I am centered, even if chaos swirls around me. As I encounter the ups and downs of daily life, I shine the light of God. Generous. I give with an open heart. I am generous. Keeping my heart open elevates my experience of generosity. If I give begrudgingly, fearful of not having enough for myself, I'm not being truly generous. There is joy and trust in being generous. There is joy in knowing there is no lack at the level of spirit, and my generous impulses are my way of demonstrating my faith in this truth. I place my trust in the spiritual truth that as I give, I also receive. Generosity is a spiritual practice, a commitment to fully participating in the flow of life. As I give generously, I receive the richness of grace, love, and peace. I relax into the flow of synchronicity and receive unexpected blessings. Generosity is the gift I give myself. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, show your hair. My grandmother told me, never hide your green hair. They can see it anyway. Angelis Arian. From the agonies of kindergarten, when we first were teased or made fun of in the midst of all our innocence, we have all struggled in one way or another with hiding what is obvious about us. No one plans this. It's not a conspiracy, but rather an inevitable and hurtful passage from knowing only ourselves to knowing the world. The tragedy is that many of us never talk about it or never get told that our green hair is beautiful or that we don't need to hide, no matter what anyone says on the way to lunch. And so we often conclude that to know the world, we must hide ourselves. Nothing could be farther from the truth. It is an ancient, unspoken fact of being that blackmail is only possible if we believe that we have something to hide. The inner corollary of this is that worthless feelings arise when we believe, however briefly, that who we are is not enough. Sit quietly with your eyes closed, and with each in-breath, feel the fact that who you are is enough. And we return to Science of Mind for the personal affirmations by Eugene Holden, RSCP. Stretch into possibilities. Back to principle. Life is naturally amazing. When left alone to do its thing, life takes care of itself and everything in it. This is law. It is principle. There is a principle of love that runs through life. Let's get back to principle and grow from there. Let's get back to love. I am the love of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Love leads the way and law makes it happen. I consciously live my life in principle. I live my life as love. Keep it simple. As remarkable as we humans are, we can sometimes make things so complicated. We get to choose how hard or simple it is to create our lives. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not. So why not keep it simple? I am the expression of God. All that God creates is good, divine, and magnificent. This includes me. The all good of God flows to me, through me, easily and effortlessly. I am grateful. Embody spirit. To live this life of God, of spirit, of the universe, we are called to fully stretch into the principles of the divine. Ask yourself what it feels like to embody love, peace, grace, and ease. Now, simply be willing to live this remarkable life you feel. I am willing to live the life of God, of spirit, of the universe. I am willing to be the life of God. I surrender to the perfection of my being. I embody spirit and allow spirit to inform all that I do. I am the love of the divine. One life. No matter how we live our lives, it is the one life of the divine expressing in so many beautiful ways. And you are just one of those beautiful ways that spirit expresses itself. As Dr. Ernest Holmes frequently affirmed, there is only one life. That life is God's perfect life. That life is my life now. I am the embodiment of these words, and so it is. And from the same issue, we turn to my favorite column. You guessed it, Murphy's Dogma. Pause, P-A-W-S, with perspective. I would be a cloud. While doing what I like to do best, which is lying on my back in the yard looking up at the sky, I notice that clouds don't conform to any specific shape. They reshape themselves 1,000 times. Sometimes they carry thunder and sometimes rain. Joining other clouds, they create mountains in the sky. They shield fragile and furry bodies like mine from the burning sun. They gather at evening's edge to create a stage on which the sun can dance and light the sky. If I could turn a cloud inside out, it would still be a perfect cloud. There is nothing you or I can say or do to change the nature of a cloud. As I lie here on the ground looking up, I confess, I'm glad I'm a dog. If I weren't a dog, I would want to be a cloud in the sky. Reflections from Dr. Bob Luckin, Things My Father Said. I remember my father saying, children should not be seen or heard. I think it was then that my best friends became snakes and possums, birds with broken wings, and a blind raccoon. It was then that I discovered nature. I am grateful now for the things my father said. I wasn't grateful then. Murphy the Human Whisperer watches over his human Reverend Bob Luckin when he isn't working on his column. Send your questions to murphy@csl.org. Regretfully, he cannot reply to all email. And from the same issue, an article by Ryan Alexander, Beyond Perfect. Folks, F-O-L-X, noun. The X in folks represents the sound of the words plural, and it also symbolizes variable. This represents the diverse and non-binary identities in the LGBTQIA+ community. Folks is used especially to explicitly signal the inclusion of groups commonly marginalized. Author's note. I want to acknowledge that fear and discomfort are the lived experience of many folks due to their identities and ability to move safely through the world. A lack of physical, emotional, and mental safety and well-being means many folks have to choose between showing up authentically or surviving. I want to highlight that reality and clarify that the context in which I am speaking of fear and discomfort is existential in nature. When I think about the definition of perfection, I can't help but get a visual of somehow reaching a fixed state where everything stops. The clouds part to reveal rays of sunshine spotlighting me. Music plays, rainbows appear, and glitter swirls. Maybe a slight exaggeration, but you get the point. There's never been a time in my life where this has occurred, and I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one. Do you know why? Because that is not how life shows up. This idea of a static, perfect state is more than a myth. It is a lie. Let's face it. We have devoted an unreasonable amount of time, energy, and focus to reach a goal that doesn't exist. I don't know how this lands for you, but I feel sort of cheated. Our own spiritual journeys and paths are not immune to this idea. If I can just meditate enough, read enough, pray enough, be spiritual enough, fill in the blank enough, then my life will be perfect. I am going to call foul on this idea, the nature of our nature. We all have bought into this lie. In a lot of spiritual circles I participated in, there was this circulating idea that we are whole, perfect, and complete. This is often said in the face of challenges as a means of distracting ourselves from the reality of what is and attempting to force what we want. I posit, and I can feel you preemptively clutching your pearls, but stay with me, that our true nature is imperfection. Since we determined that static perfection does not exist, then the alternative is a philosophy, an understanding of imperfection, defined as the ever-changing, ever-moving, ever-evolving reality of our lives. This planet, this universe, this whatever is beyond. Imperfection is not being obsessed with our flaws, but rather an understanding that nothing is static. Literally nothing. Everything changes. I changed since I first started writing this paragraph, and you changed since beginning to read it. To further solidify this idea, I turned to one of the great powerhouses of our time, Octavia Butler. She clarified this idea when she wrote, "All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change." I feel like I may be getting ahead of myself. It happens, so let's back up. Where did this idea of static perfection come from? It is impossible to track the exact moment in time when this idea began. However, we can highlight some key areas of its perpetuation. Colonialism, white supremacy, diet culture, and beauty standards. Heteronormativity, and the gender binary, just to name a few. Any instance where there is a normal or ideal standard that pushes everyone to fall in line exposes us to the seedy underbelly of the lie of perfection. The systems and frameworks we operated in were built from this understanding. They call for us to assimilate or reap the consequences. The perpetuation of these systems are the thoughts in your head when you close your eyes and dream of perfection. Notice I say they are the thoughts, not necessarily your thoughts. These thoughts include our upbringing, religious traditions, societal expectations, and a million other influences on how we see ourselves in relation to the world around us. Don't get me wrong. The idea of imperfection is uncomfortable, especially as we swim in the soup of societal expectations and influences. Take a moment to feel how your body and mind respond when I say, "You are imperfect." What thoughts and emotions do those words evoke? The words probably feel uncomfortable, even hurtful. In the statement's wake, you may feel the frantic energy to do, say, or be the right thing, trying to prove I am wrong. Some may feel the weight of the statement, sending us into paralysis, despair, and hopelessness, keeping us stuck and afraid to move. Now let's try that again with our new understanding of imperfection. You are imperfect, always changing, moving, evolving, and never static. It feels different, doesn't it? I felt the tiniest of shifts, and I imagine you did too. Our nature, the nature of everything, is the urge to move, create, try new things, embrace the unknown, rest, and then do it all again. Our blueprint is imperfection. As much as we would like to reach a static existence of perfection, this is not our internal or external experience. Our blueprint literally is imperfection. How does that land for you? Better or still challenging? For me, it feels like a weight that has been lifted. Ours is not a static existence. Therefore, perfection does not exist. Perfection is a made-up thing to perpetuate systems of inequality, inequity, injustice, phobias, isms, and so much more, none of which create a world that works for all. Here's an example from my own life. After practicing yoga for several years, I began working on the elusive pigeon pose. I practiced and practiced to perfect this pose, mainly so I didn't look a complete fraud at my local studio. The day finally came when I would have the opportunity to show off my perfect pigeon pose. There I was, surrounded by my classmates who had no idea they were in the presence of pigeon perfection. When the time came for the pigeon pose, I was in it to win it. There I was in what I thought was sheer pigeon perfection, when the instructor came over and gently pressed my shoulders down, sinking me so deep into pigeon, I swear I grew feathers. Yoga is a fantastic reminder that there is no static state, no destination where we can pronounce, I am done, I am perfect. Instead, yoga's invitation is to allow the experiences and practices of our lives to be the ever-moving activity of life, in essence, imperfection. When we embrace imperfection as the activity of life, then we begin to untangle ourselves from the loop of be better, do better, be more, do more. Life is not about striving for a static state or the be-all and end-all of existence. This doesn't mean we shouldn't embrace growth, change, evolution, or transformation in our individual or collective experiences, but we should recognize that our worth is not dependent on those things. Our value is inherent, and embracing the fluidity of imperfection is a step in the direction of understanding that reality. Be more comfortable with imperfection. In the midst of swimming in this perfection soup we're swimming in, how can we be more comfortable with our new and improved idea of imperfection? Of course, I'm going to give you three easy steps. Okay, three steps that maybe aren't so easy. First, it is important to recognize those thoughts about perfection. What ideas did we absorb? When and where did they come from? Reflect on those early influences and how they continue to shape your experience. You can then decide if these ideas and beliefs are worth keeping or if you need to trade them in for a different model. It is in this space of reflection that we can begin to intentionally move in ways that serve us. Ready for a secret? We can rest. We don't always have to strive to be better, do better, know better. We can rest sometimes, or a lot of the time. Rest is a revolutionary experience, and defiant act and resistance to the idea of perfection. Second, in our quest to embrace imperfection, we must become friends with fear and discomfort. We face these two realities daily, and our invitation is to lean into these experiences rather than avoiding them. Can you sit in this discomfort a little longer than you thought possible and then move not in a frantic way, but instead in a way that is empowering, evolutionary, and yes, even revolutionary? Can you follow Rumi's words to move but don't move the way fear makes you move? This is often my mantra in the face of life's more challenging bits. Third, I invite you to extend the same grace and understanding to those around you. As we attempt to embrace our own fluidity of imperfection, we are reminded that everyone else is attempting the same. This can be challenging, especially in the rusting framework of perfection we all live in. When we can embrace imperfection in ourselves, we can create space for others to do the same. We are always moving, changing, and evolving. And just in case you get the idea to try to perfectly embrace imperfection, I am going to stop you right there and let you in on a little secret. Ready? We don't always have to strive to be better, do better, know better. We can rest sometimes, or a lot of the time. Rest is a revolutionary experience, an act of defiance and resistance to the idea of perfection. In our daily activities, spiritual practices, and everything we do, we can just release perfection. It is not real. I invite you to use my personal mantra, given to me by a friend, when the expectations of perfection have you loaded down. It's a practice, not a perfect. So get out there and be imperfect, knowing it's your natural state, and you're a gift to this world. And in the same issue, we turn to Reverend Dr. Sonny Cantrell Smith's monthly column, Everyday Spirituality. Stretch into your vision. As we stand at the threshold of a new year, we experience a sacred opportunity to stretch into the possibilities that lie ahead. This time of year offers us a chance to pause, reflect, and envision a life and a world more aligned with the limitless nature of spirit. The turning of the calendar reminds us that every moment holds within it the seeds of transformation, the power to renew, and the promise of growth. Let us recognize that our vision for the future is not simply a wish or a resolution, but a calling from within, a whisper from the divine that asks us to trust, expand, and move forward. We are each a vessel through which spirit expresses, and as such, we are co-creators of all that is possible. When we set an intention, we place ourselves on the path of discovery, learning and stretching beyond what we once thought possible. In this moment, I encourage you to ask, what newness am I willing to welcome? What vision am I willing to hold with steadfast faith? This kind of spiritual stretching is not always comfortable, but it is always transformational. Just as muscles stretch to grow stronger, our spirits stretch when we embrace what is beyond our immediate grasp, trusting that what we reach for will meet us halfway, because what we are seeking is also seeking us. As an organization, let us join in envisioning a world where compassion, unity, and understanding flourish. Let us hold a vision for each other's growth and our collective evolution as a spiritual family. Together, we stand in the energy of potential, grounded in the knowledge that we are infinitely supported by Spirit. Let this new year be more than a change of date. Let it be a profound shift in our consciousness, a year when we embody the truth of our oneness and step boldly into the life that is calling to each of us. May we be courageous in our growth, boundless in our love, and unwavering in our faith. Here's to stretching into possibility together with Spirit as our guide. Happy New Year, beloveds. We return now to the Daily Word for February 2025 and an article by Karen Brailsford, My Journey to Yes. Call Diana. I was stopped at a light on a short drive to the market when this directive came to me. Diana is the mother of my friend Lisa. After meeting at my spiritual center in Los Angeles 17 years ago, we enjoyed theater performances, meals, and lazy, sun-drenched Sunday afternoons together. A few days earlier, Lisa told me Diana was visiting her elder daughter, who lives near where I now live on the East Coast. I dialed Diana's number. As I sat in my car in the parking lot, we caught up on our lives. Diana was effusive about the weekend workshop, Aligned with the Divine, I would be leading at a retreat center in New York's Hudson Valley 2 days later. "I know it's going to be wonderful," she said. "You, more than anyone I know, have always been good about connecting within and going with the flow." I needed that reminder. For 9 months, I had been anticipating the workshop with a mix of excitement and nervousness. Now it was time to lead it. Later, as I navigated the supermarket aisles, my workshop assistant phoned. "I guess you know why I'm calling," she said. "Actually, I didn't." She shared that she wasn't fully recovered from an illness and needed to be still. She wouldn't be coming to help me at the retreat after all. I was stunned. "I understand. And of course you should take care of yourself," I said, adding, "Are you sure you don't want to be still on the retreat center's beautiful, serene campus?" "Sadly, no." I called my partner. "I know it's going to work out, but right now I'm shaken," I said to him tearfully. After I placed my groceries in the car, Diana texted to say she was glad I had called. "Me too," I replied, then gave her the news. "Please continue to hold all in prayer." "Just a bump in the road," she wrote back. "After you cross it, something magnificent will appear." I wanted to believe her, but all I could think of was how I was being forced to contend with another change. So much for Diana's words about my always going with the flow. I thought of the many times I've had to let life carry me with my trust ebbing and flowing, the earthquake that greeted me upon my move to California, the deaths of my parents 2 years apart shortly thereafter, a marriage, a child, a divorce. I had always thrived when meeting life in all its fullness. I just wanted life not to change for a change. 3 hours later, Diana made an offer. "Karen, would you like me to be your buddy and workshop assistant?" She said she was happy to change her flight. "I think it'll be fine," I said, only half convinced, as I attempted to calm my nerves. "I don't really need an assistant, and I know of two friends who are coming." As a child, I had been taught not to inconvenience others and to say, "Thank you, but no thanks. It's in my blood." I remember one Christmas when my mother's brother saw we had no presents. I overheard him ask her, "Why didn't you tell me?" The spoken message in my family, "What happens in the house stays in the house." The unspoken message, "It's better to give than to receive." My sister and I took the latter lesson to heart and were always thrilled to give clothes we had outgrown to our younger cousins. Receiving was more of a challenge. After I rejected her offer, Diana replied, "If something happens and you change your mind, just let me know." I realized that my breathing had been shallow. I inhaled and exhaled slowly, gratefully feeling into the space Diana had granted me by allowing me to engage in that most human of practices, changing my mind. I realized I was no longer that little girl who had to keep secrets. I didn't have to maintain a brave front and hide my true feelings, afraid to be vulnerable. I could express my needs and accept help. This was the gift I could give myself. I began to think about logistics. My travel plans with my original assistant were complicated, entailing a complex journey of trains and Uber rides. I was expecting a cumbersome time transporting the items I wanted to place on the altar I would create for the workshop space. Diana was willing to rent a car and drive. After I meditated, the answer was clear. Of course, I had to say yes. It was the most loving, most practical thing to do for my own well-being. I realized I could be vulnerable and accept help. And isn't that what it really means to align with the divine? I was present with my authentic feelings by connecting within and reaching a state of clarity. During the weekend, it became clear that Diana, along with many other participants, were having insights of their own. You and Diana make a great team, one woman noted. I couldn't have agreed with her more. Karen Brailsford is the author of Sacred Landscapes of the Soul, Aligning with the Divine Wherever You Are, and is a licensed spiritual practitioner with the Agape International Spiritual Center. Learn more at KarenBrailsford.com, KarenBrailsford.com. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications. And you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. We return now to Rainn Wilson's Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. We had started Chapter 9, The Broken Blue Marble. We are watching the birth more than the death of a world, Father Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. One thing I'm struck by when I read the news is how strangely disordered, how broken all the modern organizational structures are. I mean, what field of endeavor or area of business, society, or government is not broken? Name an existing system, large or small, and chances are it's essentially out of whack at a fundamental level. I'm going to spend the next few pages briefly describing some systems that are gravely, strangely, out of balance, most specifically in the United States. Obviously, I don't have the time, room, or expertise to go into detail in these pages. I'm simply trying to set the scene to make a much larger point, which means, yes, things will get a little dark, but we'll get to some uplifting solutions before too long. Promise. Some strange disorders, in no particular order. If you talk to a doctor, nurse, or a public health official, they will tell you in endless detail all the ways our healthcare system in the United States is fractured, unfair, dysfunctional, and unjust. And don't get anyone started on the complete lack of any kind of mental health care policy in our country. Direct evidence of this system-wide dysfunction can be seen in the opioid epidemic, which continues to ravage the country and has taken 500,000 lives in the last 20 years. This is due in large part to our broken, corrupt healthcare system being so directly enmeshed with the broken, corrupt pharmaceutical industry, or Big Pharma, the five large global companies that essentially control the entire pharmacological ecosystem. Moving on. If you speak to any teacher or school administrator, you will hear the same thing about education. Underprioritized, overcrowded, dysfunctional, political corruption and union battles, a rapidly degrading system that is funded based on local property tax values, so the poorest neighborhoods are continually left behind. And one can't bring up schools without mentioning the epidemic of school shootings. Gun ownership and reasonable firearms regulation is another broken system in our country. We have more than 120 guns for every 100 people in the United States, and yet it's harder for a teenager to get a driver's license than an AR-15. While most Americans want common sense gun registration laws enacted, nothing changes as mass shootings continue unabated. The debate has become entrenched and deadlocked, driven by partisanship and funding from a massive gun lobby, all while children continue to get gunned down in classrooms. The criminal justice and prison system is another area that has grotesque systemic imbalances and racist policies that haven't been altered in 100 years. Mass incarceration of blacks and Latinos, a bail system that criminalizes being poor. And what about the foster care system? Immigration policies, unaffordable and unsubsidized daycare and child care, the housing crisis and the unhoused population, modern university education, staggering tuition and student loans, and the bizarrely insular world of American academia. all struggling with brokenness in one form or another. And don't get me started on modern news media, corralling viewers with incessant fear-mongering and endless shouting matches. Opinion journalism is regularly gussied up as factual news, while the whole for-profit enterprise is entirely funded by one emotion, outrage. Outrage fuels an ever-incensed viewership, brand loyalty, and click-throughs on websites. Think about all the things off-kilter about agriculture that allows massive government subsidies for gigantic corporate farms that mono-farms single crops, usually corn and soybeans, saturating them with fertilizers and pesticides that cause health issues and deplete the soil. Two companies, Cargill and COFCO, own 40% of the global commercial seeds. A huge amount of increasingly precious water is systematically wasted. Meanwhile, in food deserts, junk food is cheaper and more available to the low-income consumer than fruits and vegetables, which fuels diabetes and the obesity epidemic, which in turn overwhelms the healthcare system. And we're right back where we started. Now on to my field, show business. A swamp rife with bloated, toxic personalities and the relentless pursuit of who's hot and who's not. Starfuckers all, youth-obsessed. Millions wasted on vanity projects and outrageous salaries, ineffectual management of networks and studios by inexperienced, arrogant executives who are driven by fear, anxiety, and bloated egos that drive the creation of countless hours of mediocre content. But maybe I'm a bit biased. Chances are there are another few thousand fields of endeavor that, for those who work in them, are just as flawed, dysfunctional, and fractured. Fields as divergent as, oh, I don't know, regional table tennis competitions, international freight shipping, medieval archaeology, and the traveling circus. Now let's turn our attention to the government. Ugh, the worst, right? I mean, where do you start? Gerrymandering, super PACs and campaign finance, national debt, unchecked military spending, $800 billion in 2021, social security, pork barrel politics, waste, bureaucracy. I'm going to bypass all these issues and go right to the mother of all brokenness in our government, the partisan politics of the two-party system. Hundreds of books have been written on the history of political parties in America, their ups and downs, when they actually worked, if they ever actually worked, and the devolvement into the current morass of the last half century. Not my area of expertise in the slightest, but it's important to shine a light on this particular apparatus for a moment because it is a barometer and bellwether of most everything that is out of balance with modern society. Basically, I believe the toxicity of partisanship is one of the greatest threats to our way of life, the future of our nation, and perhaps the fate of the world. The reason it is so particularly pernicious today is because the diseased roots of this adversarialist system go back over 200 years. Don't believe me? Many of our beloved founding fathers are with me on this. There is nothing which I dread so much as a division of the Republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader and concerting measures in opposition to each other. This, in my humble apprehension, is to be dreaded as the greatest political evil under our Constitution. President John Adams. I heard a podcast recently about soccer football hooliganism in Argentina. There are these gangs of obsessive club fans called Barras Bravas who are responsible for hundreds of deaths and thousands of violent acts and injuries. Politics and soccer are so enmeshed in Argentina that politicians run for office with the support of their local club gangs, who are also involved in what essentially boils down to organized crime. The Barras Bravas provide muscle for the politicians and receive favors in return. They are in charge of parking and concessions and frequently sell drugs as part of their business model. They also actually help control who plays for the club and who manages the teams. The violence has been so bad, in fact, that in Buenos Aires, only hometown fans can go to games at the home stadiums. Visiting fans were just getting beat up and killed too much to attend games in opposing stadiums. Imagine what our friend Skubash and would have to say about the Barras Bravas. I'll let you compose that dialogue yourself. And for those that didn't listen, these were two aliens having a conversation in an earlier chapter. All this over a game where you kick a ball around. The beautiful game. Why do I bring this up? Well, because to me it reminded me on a core level of how partisan politics works. The loyalty, which can verge on violent fanaticism for one's political party affiliations, often seems as random as the fandom loyalty for a soccer team. America has two gigantic, gang-backed, flush-with-cash soccer clubs called the Republican and Democratic Parties, and we have pledged our loyalty to our teams come hell or high water. It doesn't matter if a candidate from either party is grossly unfit for office or riddled with hypocrisy. We vote for them based on our affiliation. What about actual policy, you might ask? Don't people vote for policy? Yes and no. While there are some substantial political differences between the two parties, the opinions of actual voters are often more alike than we probably realize. Members of both parties, when you sift through the data and polling, are remarkably in agreement on countless items: fixing immigration laws, reducing health care costs, reducing greenhouse gases, and having automotive fuel efficiency regulations, raising the minimum wage, reasonable gun regulation, reforming campaign financing, nuclear arms control, a balanced federal budget, and counteracting gerrymandering. These are all shared priorities. Members of both parties adore the working class, farmers, nurses, and construction workers, and distrust the moneyed elite. Both generally distrust the government and large corporations. So with all this agreement, why is there so much discord? Of course, there are many policies and issues that the political right and left disagree on. While members of both parties might agree on the what, that immigration needs to be reformed, for example, the how of such a reform couldn't be more divergent. But do we ever hear about the areas of shared alignment on so many of those issues? Never. Instead, it's disagreements and deadlocks. The image that's drummed up by politicians, the media, and the parties themselves is that the other side are monsters threatening the American way of life. Call me old-fashioned, but I thought our political system was supposed to be about finding public servants to transparently, fairly, and selflessly enact the policy positions that benefit the most people. Unfortunately, it's not. It's about getting and holding power, getting 51% of the votes. It's about winning, not governing. It's about victory instead of sharing, uniting, and healing. And it's often about money. On both the left and right, you'll hear solutions offered for this massive problem of broken politics. If some political condition can be met, then things will get substantially better and turn a corner. Things like, we need another Obama, Reagan, Kennedy. Insert the dynamic, charismatic president of your choice. We need our party to win a supermajority in Congress. We need to go back to the good old days of polite political cooperation. We need less woke policing. We need less unjust gerrymandering. We need a third party. We need to undo the Electoral College. We need to get rid of the filibuster. We need campaign finance reform. We need more Supreme Court justices. But even if we did make several or all of these changes, the system would find some way to eat itself from the inside out. Like so many of the previous broken systems we examined, the entire way we elect public officials needs to be completely reimagined. It can't be fixed with Band-Aids. Here's the crux of the matter. People so rarely think that partisanship itself is broken, only that the opposing party is broken. Picture partisan politics as a house being held up by two giant support beams. Both have termites, black mold, and water damage. No amount of repairing windows or appliances or floorboards or shingles will make the rot underneath go away. And if you add a third or fourth or fifth beam, the rot will only spread, and we'll find ourselves in the same situation. Why? Because the entire foundation is constructed on a faulty, unsustainable premise. This imaginary house we're discussing, the partisan political system, is based on the proposition that winning, no matter what, is the ultimate goal, and that these win-at-all-cost goals are best achieved by competition, contest, one-upmanship, power, control, backstabbing, bluster, rivalry, domination, aggression, contention, and most importantly, money. Lots and lots and lots of money. We need an altogether new foundation, a solid and balanced one, one held up by cooperation, unity, humility, and selfless service. A foundation where the goal is the maximum good for all, especially those who have been traditionally left out. Building that foundation is where the real work lies. I know, naive, unrealistic, unobtainable, insert collective eye roll here. How do we get there, idiot, you might be asking at this juncture. Well, that's kind of the point of this book. And besides, it's about time we got to the whole revolution part, isn't it? Yes, it most certainly is. And remember, the reason I paint so bleak a picture is to remind us all of how high the stakes are, what we're up against. And if we're going to have a rebellion, even a spiritual one, don't we need to understand what it is that we're rebelling against? Remember, we're collectively hitching our wagons to the unifying forces of integration and witnessing, confronting, and overcoming those dastardly forces of disintegration. Before we get to the revolution itself, let's recap our journey thus far and set us up for the final chapter. I talked about how we're on a spiritual journey on both an individual and a collective level, part Kung Fu and part Star Trek. How our personal path is crucial, but we must also consider a larger soul vision for our planet, our species, humanity's transition out of its raging adolescence and toward its inevitable maturity. We did a fairly extensive tour of a lot of the obstacles that lie before us. I describe these issues as problems so all-encompassing that they really should be thought of as pandemics. In this chapter, I companioned those pandemics with a glimpse into the many broken systems around us. Systems built on old assumptions and unsustainable conflict, greed, opposition, and self-interest. Waxing mystical for a few chapters, we delved into some of the deepest possible human topics and their spiritual reverberations, like death, atheism, religion, consciousness, the sacred, and the granddaddy of all granddaddies, God. We explored the idea that men die miserably every day for lack of what is found in the holy writings of the great spiritual traditions. I propose that many of the spiritual themes and practices that we take for granted may require a deeper examination and redefinition. Words like God, religion, faith, soul, sacred, and pilgrimage, I even strove to bring us back to some occasional kernels of indigenous wisdom to put things into perspective. I spent several chapters excavating the idea of religion because for all the destruction they have perpetuated on our planet, I believe faiths serve a purpose. So much of what religion can provide is what we're going to need in order to effect a true paradigm shift. We even got to create a super cool new religion, Soul Boom, based on those foundational concepts and some other groundbreaking ideas for a grassroots religious movement. Why did we cover all this? Because all these big spiritual ideas that make up the majority of this book are often waylaid by folks' general distaste for religion itself. We've thrown the spiritual baby out with the religious bathwater, and in doing so have lost access to a treasure trove of wisdom and perspective that might truly aid our maturation. I believe that only by recognizing that we are, in fact, spiritual beings, having a collective human experience, will we be open to the kinds of soul-level transformations we're going to need to make, the spiritual revolution that this book promises, a revolution that is urgent and necessary in the healing of our beautiful but broken blue marble. And remember, the ultimate aim of this endeavor is my grand attempt to advance a conversation about the importance of the divine dimension of existence and how it can influence our lives and our futures, collectively and individually. So there you have it. The pot has been stirred, discussions had, questions raised, perspectives shifted, countless opinions blathered on about by the author. Topics both profound and mundane have been sifted through, and to continue the cooking metaphor, hopefully enough spiritual ingredients have been added to the Soul Boom stew for us to open our hearts, minds, and taste buds to what is next, because it's time for a spiritual revolution. Chapter 10, The Seven Pillars of a Spiritual Revolution. We can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. Albert Einstein. When I was a teenager, I had to buy my own car, and as I had no money, if I wanted it to run, I had to learn how to fix it. I was 19 and working full-time driving a delivery truck for Ballard Marine Supply and Hardware and attending the University of Washington on the side, and I bought an old Volvo for $400. It was a dilapidated piece of junk, but thankfully, it was a hardy piece of junk. I affectionately called this car the Newt, after the burning of the witch scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. The Newt's claim to fame was that I could pull the stick shift up and out of the transmission while driving, which would create a large hole that you could peer down into and see the pavement whooshing along about a foot and a half underneath the car floor. Occasionally, I would take a girl out on a date and, while driving, pull the shifter lever thingy over and let out a panicked scream as if I'd lost control of the car before sticking it back in again. This never went over terribly well, but I continued doing it because it made me laugh, and unfortunately, that's just the kind of person I am. Over the course of the year with the Newt, I personally changed the starter and the muffler and the brakes and calipers and the battery and the tires and routinely changed my own oil and filters. I got to know and annoy the guys at the local auto parts shop as I would pepper them with questions. I would love to say that all this effort and sweat set me up with a valuable set of life skills, but mostly it was just a colossal pain in the ass. I did learn something quite interesting about cars over that long, impoverished year, however. A car, at its simplest, is a metal contraption with an internal combustion engine that transports passengers on four wheels. At its most complex, it's a series of interconnected systems all working together to power a moving vehicle. The number of structures that need to work in harmony are various and many. Besides its body and drivetrain, every car has an electrical system, a transmission, a fuel system, an ignition, and an exhaust system. And when something is not working, you look under the hood or crawl underneath, or if you have a real-life automotive garage, you put it up on the lift and take a look in order to try and determine which of these systems is not functioning correctly. We can do the same kind of examination for the web of integrated systems that allow human society to operate. Continuing with this terrible analogy, if we put the car of humanity up on a lift and take a look around at what's not working, what would we diagnose? Instead of transmission and brakes, we examine healthcare and education. Instead of exhaust and air conditioning, we shine our headlamps onto international trade, human rights, or agriculture. Is it one or two systems that are out of whack, or is it something more pervasive going on? As we discussed in the previous chapter, it seems that practically every single societal structure has some serious irregularities and design flaws, and most importantly, the systems don't work together in harmony the way they're supposed to. Before I give my personal soul boom diagnosis of what's wrong with the car of humanity, ugh, I truly hate this analogy, let's take a long look forward to where we want to go. Hey kids, let's build the perfect world. Earlier in the book, we assembled some elements for a new, awesome religion. How about we do the same, John Lennon style, to imagine the perfect world? Harkening back to the Blue Marble and all those sappy Miss America contestants from the 70s, what would the ingredients be to build this harmonious world? What is the soul boom vision for a peaceful, just, and united planet filled with a kind and fulfilled population? Well, guess what? We already know what the answer is going to be. I really don't need to take up much space in these pages to explore it. It's quite basic, really. The vision of what the aforementioned kingdom of God on earth looks like is like Star Trek, but instead of zipping around in space, we're dwelling peacefully on our home planet, Earth. Everyone gets along. As hippy-dippy as that may sound, it's really that simple. In a nutshell, there's no more war. Armaments are just enough to defend a nation from attack. When there are disagreements, the various countries of the world come together to work out their conflicts with the greater good in mind. The differences between our cultures will be celebrated so that unity shines through in a diversity of humanity. There will probably always be some degree of rich and poor, but the extremes will not be so, well, extreme. There will be enough food, enough challenging employment, enough clean water, and enough cheap, renewable energy to keep our population both content and motivated. The arts and sciences will thrive and be incorporated into all facets of our various cultures. Education will be eminently available without any ideology or agenda except knowledge and enlightenment, with some tangible job training thrown in. Healthcare will be accessible and thorough and treat every patient with dignity. Like our indigenous ancestors, we will cherish our planet, honor its resources and beauty, and seek to live sustainably for the generations that follow. Most importantly, in emulation of Jesus Christ, we will all love our neighbors as ourselves. We will live in service to one another with kindness and care for the downtrodden and a deep respect for one another. You get the idea. Like I said, regardless of political view or religious belief, we can all visualize this utopian future quite easily. But, and this is the trillion-dollar question, how do we get there? Do we achieve this lofty goal by making modest reforms, tweaks, and adjustments to existing organizations and ways of doing things? Well, let's go back to my stupid car analogy. Maybe before this book ends, I can find a better one. What do I see when I look under the hood of humanity? I see a series of systems, as we previously explored, that have been faultily, unsustainably engineered. Design tweaks, legislation, and more checks and balances won't repair the essential brokenness. That would be the equivalent of using duct tape, band-aids, and chewing gum to try to jury-rig a solution to a much larger issue. It comes down to this. The many and various adversarial systems that run our world are driven by and founded on some of the worst qualities of our species: aggression, self-interest, greed, disunity, hunger for power, and self-aggrandizement. Ego, one-upmanship, business, sports, and government actually all essentially run on the same fuel of combative competition. So to continue the preposterous automotive metaphor, we're headed for a breakdown. We have a spiritual imbalance, a spiritual disease, and the answer, rather than being political, economic, or legislative, is primarily spiritual as well. A spiritual solution for an essentially spiritual problem. Of course, we need to acknowledge that in part we have an innate adversarial nature, and that it's an aspect of our species, our history, and our Homo sapiens reality. But we don't need to be the victims of those baser impulses. We don't have to build our society on them and their dynamics. We need to transition from basing our systems on the worst qualities of humanity to basing them on the best of humanity. And what is that exactly? What is this rumored best of humanity? I'll tell you. It's the essential spiritual qualities illumined by the deep reservoir of religious teachings that go back to the dawn of time. Ancient wisdom combined with divine attributes and positive character traits. Selflessness, kindness, compassion, humility, honesty, and generosity. And dozens of other virtues as well. As crazily simplistic as it may sound, it all boils down to working together in cooperation rather than opposing each other in competition and conflict. The essence of this work is summed up by one of my all-time most cherished quotes by everyone's favorite philosopher, architect, futurist, Buckminster Fuller. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. Well, we will continue with this book in the future programs. For now, I wish you all a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.